Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Peter's joining me again today. Thank you, Peter.
Hey, Daniel. Good to see you.
You as well. All right. So we've been talking about society and a lot of the underpinnings that the faults, the distractions, and there are more distractions to talk about today, but we're going to talk about them on a different front. So on the geopolitical landscape, I think for our listeners, and you know, some of you may realize this and others may not, I like to think of the United States as the global free trade regime. So what does that mean? Well, we've been playing world police for the past 70 years almost. Yeah. And with that comes a few things. If you think about why? A lot of people want to say, okay, why are we in Iraq? Well, the Iraqi government's requested the U.S. military presence stay there because there's so many destabilizing efforts by the Iranians in Iraq. The people, the government officials in Iraq that are against U.S. involvement are pretty much Iranian proxy puppets. So there's something there. And I'm going to get into this further. I'm just painting a picture. Syria, the border, oil. It's all about oil, right? Anybody knows this. I mean, Dave Chappelle joked about this in 2004 when he was Black Bush, I think. So it's all about the oil. We know that. Some, you know, freedom, liberation, whatever. Yeah, Saddam Hussein ruled, but with an iron fist, because he knew how to keep all the individual tribes and groups, if you will, in check. Fear. And that works. Bashar al-Assad does the same thing. I'm not agreeing with their tactics at all. I don't agree with them at all. However,
this is the reality.
It's the reality. When you, and so we go into Iraq and we supplant leadership, easily take that over. That's not the problem. The problem therein lies holding it, right? Insurgency. Well, the Iranians are going to feel that insurgency, and they certainly did. There's other regional actors, and what people may not know is that Russia was there before us. In Afghanistan, it's this ideological combat, if you will, at scale. But from a military perspective, it's all about resources, right? We're securing resources and regions. Half the U.S. Navy's budget, and as of 2017, was going to keeping open the Straits of Hormuz.
Hormuz.
And the Gulf of Aden, right? So, like the two straits where the oil is coming out of Qatar and UAE and Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, obviously, Saudi Aramco, and coming all the way back, taking the short path through Egypt and the Suez Canal, I believe, and over to the Mediterranean, either to Europe or over to the United States. So you can go around the Cape of Africa, but it increases the transit time significantly. So whoever controls those water flows is holding a lot of dollar bills, frankly. Yeah. Now, the other thing to consider is that the U.S. dollar, as of a year or two ago, the only currency that oil was traded in globally. So if you want to think about the gold standard being taken away and the U.S. dollar being funny money, it wasn't necessarily funny money because it was still backed by the largest traded commodity in the world.
Yeah.
That's changing now, right? The geopolitical structure in the Middle East is significant because the free flow of oil to Western Europe, our other allies and principal trading partners throughout the world.
Yeah.
Right? So there's some underlying economic fabric that goes on in the region. Now, I'm not condoning killing anybody. I'm not condoning overthrowing governments. I'm not at all. And in fact, we can see you can't implement freedom anywhere because the individuals have to want it themselves. And if they're not willing to stand up for it themselves, then you have nothing. The closest place that you see that happening right now is Taiwan. Mm-hmm. That never happened in Iraq. They have some degree of it now. The Iranians oddly had it before the revolution in 79. Well, some would say puppet state of the United States, and certainly wasn't a bad relationship, that's for sure. However, well, why? Well, the Iranians also have a plethora of oil. So it's just a casual observation that everywhere there's an abundance of natural resources, there's a lot of governmental corruption, let's say. So anyway, corruption's another thing. It's another thing. Are we corrupt in the West? Yes. Are other countries throughout the world more corrupt typically? Yes. And it's because if you have fewer people in the government, it's easier to capture them.
Yeah.
Right. And that could be through money. It could be through blackmail. It could be through a combination. And once you have that, who are you working for? You're not working for the people anymore. So this is a legitimate concern, right? And we can talk about that on industry. And I plan on talking about that at the industrial level in the United States in a future episode. So I just want to, listeners, but for this episode. All right, Peter. So I've just talked for far too long to kind of lay a framework for the global geopolitical scale and some of the shifts that we're seeing, at least initially. So please.
So the root cause of all of this is energy, not correct. Just petrochemicals, but energy, right? Why? Energy is what drives economies. You know, look at any satellite picture you can get and compare South Korea and North Korea.
Oh my gosh. That,
yeah. That tells you the imbalance of power, right? And you don't have to look at anything else other than how many lights are visible at night. Yeah. Those lights have to get powered by something, whether they're coal-fired plants or gas-fired plants or nuke plants or whatever it is. South Korea has plenty of them, and they have a great standard to live in. North Korea, the polar opposite. So, okay, if this is what, you know, the whole core of the crux is, or the crux of the matter, you know, what's that say about, you know, the entire situation in the Middle East, which, by the way, has been horked since day one. You know why? Because, you know, back then the imperial powers, and, you know, we're talking the 20s, so it isn't even like it's ancient history. No. You know, as soon as they discovered that there was oil in the region, you know, Britain got out the old playbook that they ran in Africa and said, okay, we're doing the same thing in the Middle East. And they carved up what we think of as the modern countries, you know, out of the remnants of the Ottoman Empire after World War I, specifically to make sure that they could exploit each area as much as they could for oil, and intentionally drew these boundaries that would cross ethnic tribal lines, you know, whatever was extant at the time, because, you know, there's a lot of, you know, different nationalities, ethnic groups, whatever in that area. And they don't live in the nice little borders that we've, you know, painted on the map. Whether or not this was moral, I don't think is in dispute. It wasn't moral. But, you know, nations don't have friends. They don't have enemies. They have interests. And sometimes those interests coincide with the common good. Sometimes they don't. More often than not, those interests get hijacked by, you know, the insider elite to, you know, line their own pockets and, you know, advance their own agendas. We saw the beginning of the mess that we're in now 100 years ago in the ashes of World War I, where the 19th century empires were trying to dominate the 20th century. They miscalculated everything at every step, resulting in World War II and, you know, the post-war order that we're still in, that I think we're starting to see change. And I think a lot of the, you know, warfare that we're seeing now is the 20th century empires trying to position themselves for the 21st century. And, you know, whether or not they're making the right geopolitical, you know, economic, military moves, I think the jury's still out. I think there's a lot of mistakes being made, and we're not going to understand that for a few years yet.
Hindsight's 20/20, as they say.
Yeah. But, and, you know, even, you know, let's say it takes 20 years to get some type of idea. We're halfway done with the century. You know, historically, that's when you go through another, you know, sea change, because look what happened 1850s, 1860s globally. What happened in the 1950s, 1960s globally, right? Both decades of unrest is, you know, the first half morphed into the second half, where the power that seized the groups that seized power in the first half were trying to consolidate and, you know, expand it in the second half, right?
Yeah.
I think we're in the beginning stages of that right now.
I agree. And in the West, we also have to compete with the ideologies that come out through discourse or lack thereof. So, obviously you see waves of that happening post-World War II in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. So each generation has their own unique problems. And again, something else to talk about in the future. But it does play a role into the decision-making that happens, right?
I think, before I lose the thought too, what you spoke earlier about, people, we want freedom and we want democracy. Nobody ever said that. All right. That's, propaganda lies that get pointed out here. Because if you really want democracy and freedom and you want the right to self-determination, you're going to fight for it. Right. Nobody's going to ask a foreign power to come in and say, free us. Right. It doesn't work that way. It never has. And especially today, that's ludicrous to assume that that's ever the position. I mean, I keep on telling, just let me finish the thought. I keep on telling, the younger guys that I talk to, don't believe it. It's all lies. When they tell you have to go to war, instantly say, no, we don't. Because in, my 54 years, I've never seen a justification for war in anything that's happened. Right. World War II may be a little different, and actually it was a little different. I shouldn't say that. It was a lot different because, there were clear, good and evil going on then. And even then, that was, as it progressed, it could have been avoided, I think, with a lot of the bloodshed and the Holocaust and all of that. If these, power structures that existed at the time weren't so hell-bent on maintaining, the status quo of a world that already didn't exist anymore at that time. I think the lessons are worth learning.
Well, and then there was all kinds of political polarization that happened in Europe that led to that, specifically in Germany.
But we're in the same mix again, right?
That's exactly why I bring it up.
Yeah. And nothing has changed. It's just the names have changed, the places have changed, the faces are different, but the underlying themes, forces, desires and wants are the same because, human nature is the same.
Right. Absolutely right. You hit on a few points. One, it is all about energy. It's about the free flow of energy and subsequently the free flow of trade throughout the world and the countries that want to participate in that.
Because they go hand in hand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You can look at the top 20 countries by GDP and pretty much correlate energy consumption per capita accordingly. They are linear. So there's many forms of energy, and there are a lot of things involved there. However, the Korea thing is a great example. I used to live in South Korea, so when I'd fly to Incheon and at night, you can see very starkly how bright it is on the right side of the aircraft as opposed to the left. Typically, you're coming in from the other side of the country. So it's just because it's positioned on the ocean, and you have to stay away from the border of North Korea for those of you who haven't been there. So, and it's so telling. It's so telling. Well, that's it. We can do a whole episode about that. When we think about the geopolitical structure in the Middle East specifically. So now we have Russia, which has been fighting in Ukraine for 3 years now, almost in March.
Overtly at least.
Yeah. Overtly. Certainly since 2014. And it's so, I don't want to get into the war elements of that, but you can actually think about it as restructuring the environment. The Russians believe typically that the West is a threat to them because of our societal values, typically. Yeah. And I can't always disagree with that sentiment. I don't think it's a justification to go invade a country.
That's an excuse, right?
It's absolutely never an excuse.
Yeah, countries never go to war over ideology.
It's why did
over money?
Well, yeah. Well, why did they capture Crimea in 2014?
Yeah,
control of ports, access, Black Sea. Bridge, Black Sea. Exactly. Like Russia, they have Vladivostok on the Far East in the Pacific, but from an Atlantic territory, they're penned up there, pretty high. There's a lot of ice up there, you know, as far as their, you know, Kaliningrad being a very small area that's actually in between Russia and Poland, I believe, and which is on the ocean, and they have a very large naval base there. But even that isn't incredibly prominent. So having them having full control of the Black Sea and the fleet capabilities and the flow of transport and energy, Russia is also a huge producer of energy.
Right.
And like very large on the list. And I think in the reserve list, I think they're in the top three or four with proven reserves. I think it's Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Canada, and Russia.
Yeah.
If I recall. So there's a lot to gain. Now, if they don't have to trade in the US dollar anymore, there's also a lot to gain. And if they undermine the US position and the global free trade regime, which we'll call Western Europe, Western and Central Europe, and Japan, Singapore, Australia, used to be Hong Kong, Taiwan, et cetera. So the countries that are willing to actively participate in the system, that we have mutual respect for the ability to trade with each other and the business dealings that we're going to engage in. Contracts are enforceable, typically intellectual property is protected accordingly. As intellectual property is not really protected in China. In fact, China's number one for stealing technology.
IP theft,
this is pretty well known.
It's national policy.
Exactly. It's like, lie, cheat, and steal to get to the top.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, that works when your competition's bigger than you, but what happens when you, you know, you become the biggest, you know? So you lie, cheat, and steal from yourself? Probably.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway, I'm not saying that all Chinese people do that. Not at all.
No, we're talking national policy.
We're talking about national policy. Exactly.
Yeah.
And that lends itself to another thought, which is why do people want to come to the United States typically? I'm not talking about any border crisis perceived or otherwise. I'm talking about why does the average person want to come to the United States? For opportunity.
Yeah.
Right? For opportunity. All kinds. All kinds of opportunity.
Yeah. And the, I guess it is a form of opportunity, but the ability to be left alone to do what you want. Right?
Right.
You know, nobody cares what you believe, you know, where you live, who you hang out with. Right?
Right. You're not going to get killed for being Christian yet. You're not going to, you know, be in danger typically, depending on where you live. So, and you'll have freedom to participate fully in the most developed economy in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So you get access to education that should be the best in the world subsequently. Should be, as in quotes.
Such as it is.
Yeah, exactly. I think we kind of painted at least a rough picture of where we're at. So when we look at the flows in the Middle East, it's all about energy. Energy fuels trade. Trade fuels economic flows between countries. There, you know, we could talk about macro and microeconomics. This is not probably the forum for that. But the key points to remember are that the actions by the United States have enabled this thus far, right? Now, to Peter's point, we have Russia, we have Iran, huge actor in the Middle East, and we have China, all three of which would love to have control of the trade, of the flows of energy, of all the revenue sources, and the ability to shape the world as they would like. Neither one of them independently has the strength to stand up to the United States.
I don't know. I think I'd argue that.
I think they
lack the political will. You know, on a pure strength basis, China has the largest standing army in the world.
But they're also landlocked, so they're not going to get across the ocean because we have the largest navy in the world. So,
yeah, I think, you know, globally, yeah, I'd agree with that statement. But regionally, each one of these powers could and does cause all kinds of havoc for their own interest.
And that's exactly the point I'm making. It's regional.
I guess the debate is of those three, who has the political acumen to leverage their geography to advance their political aims, with the greatest force amplification. And I think it's Russia. I think China has, you know, way too many internal structural problems that are really starting to come to the fore. That's going to severely limit whatever, you know, global aspirations they may have once had.
Yeah. Well, yes, I agreed. It's the over-authoritarian approach will produce rifts over time. So you can have nationalism for a period.
Yeah.
Right. But what the control and the life, and I know it's different there. And like I said, I lived in Korea. It's similar in a way, but the expectations are very high generally, but it's different. I think, you know, even the time that I spent in Hong Kong, you know, like if anybody's been to Hong Kong, that is the most developed port of transit I have ever seen.
I don't think you can even compare them to China. They're really an entirely different world.
Yeah. You see the British influence there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. As far as I could see from the hotel and the drive from the airport, all you see is container ships and ports for loading all the containers from, I guess, mainland China, typically, onto ships to transit to destinations. So there's so much trade that's happening in these areas, and control of – I think it's more about the system, though, and that's really what I want to talk about here. So with the U.S. leading the, you know, free trade – global free trade regime, we all at least know how we're playing ball. It's generally fair in the sense that anybody who wants to participate can participate. You just have to
accept certain rules.
You have to accept certain rules. Exactly. Yeah. So the Russians, being a kleptocracy, generally. Well, and so this is actually what scares me a little bit. So the Russians, and I agree with your point, because the grievances that the Russian populace have against the West are probably warranted. They have the largest landmass. They have probably the largest nuclear arsenal. Be it dated slightly, but whatever.
Yeah, it still goes boom.
They still have closed cities.
Yeah.
Right? That you can't, like, even residents that work in these, you know, military research facilities can't leave the cities without special permission. They can't leave the country ever.
Yeah. I personally I did business in Moscow, for a while, some time back.
Yeah.
And the main person I was dealing with, I met his father, who didn't speak English, but a very nice guy. You know, I mean, brought me out to dinner. We had a great time. And, you know, older guy. And, you know, I through his son, I said, oh, so what do you do? Oh, you know, I developed radar systems for the Soviets. I said, oh, okay. He says, yeah, it's good. They still pay me a pension. And, you know, I get a nice apartment, so they take care of me. I'm like, oh, that's nice. So do you ever visit your son in the UK? He's like, no, it's too difficult. I still have to get special permission to leave the country because of the radar systems I worked on in the 1970s. Exactly. So it's funny how, you know, things change, but they don't.
Yeah. That's exactly the point I'm trying to make here. Like, they change, but they don't, you know, like Russia is a democracy now on paper.
Yeah.
In reality, I think it's pretty obvious that that's not the case. This is not.
It's for me purely. If you take the long view, it's really Imperial Russia all over. They just, you know, have reskinned it with different names for different positions. But, you know, I don't think anybody rational is going to say Putin isn't the czar. Let's be honest.
Well, no, you don't. Even friends of mine that are Russian, and some live in Russia right now, have long said that, like, I vote. I know that just gets thrown away, but I vote. You know,
make the effort.
They're not delusional.
Yeah.
That's kind of funny, but also not. All right. So if you look at the Russians, right, they have a lot going for them. At the start of the war, they thought they were going to roll Ukraine. The Ukrainians fought back. You kind of think about it like they're cleaning house, if you will, which is not a great way to look at it, because they lost a lot of soldiers. But what they've actually done throughout the last 3 years is reignite their military industrial complex within Russia. That's what's happened.
I don't think a lot of people are talking about that, but that's an astute point.
Yeah. So think about it. They're picking it up. They're manufacturing more tanks in a month almost now than Ukraine can destroy.
Yeah.
So at some point, there has to be capitulation. You know, what is that doing? Also, they're retraining their military. The people who are in the military, it's more like a paper tiger is what it's referred to me. I knew someone who was in the military in Russia and then came to the United States and was in the U.S. military. And I asked him, I said, what's the difference? And he said, it's night and day. In the United States, we actually practice drill exercise live. In Russia, we just clean the tank. Right? So like that's what they were like, make sure the tanks are clean. And Russia has a huge, like they're a ground army. Principally, they have nuclear arsenal, very large, but they also have over 14,000 tanks.
Yeah.
It's the largest armor mechanized army.
But given their landmass, that makes sense, right?
It does. They were also undertrained and understaffed at the start of the war. However, reignite the complex, military weapons development, tank land development, and personnel training, right? So now, like, they have to actually train people because it's not working out well. And there were reports at the start of the Ukrainian war where the actual soldiers didn't think anything was going to happen. They were told they're just going to exercise by the border for a while, and then all of a sudden they're lining up on a convoy to Kyiv, you know? So,
but that leads into the point I wanted to make, is that the difference is that it's a conscript army, and it's treated like a conscript army.
Exactly.
Or has been, at least historically. The interesting thing to see, will they learn from this and go to a more professional military in the future?
I think they are.
If they do, the equation changes substantially at that point.
That's kind of the point that I'm making. I've followed the Ukrainian conflict pretty heavily since it broke out. And that's the reason why I made the point, the reignition of the military industrial complex in Russia. They get money from energy, and they can create jobs and develop their economy around that. They have partnerships with the Iranians where they're buying drones and using those drones, so they don't have to develop their own. However, they are actually using microchips on the drones to find the down drone, down drones. So if the Ukrainians shoot down a drone and their forces can get it, they now have a GPS sensor that they've developed, that someone's developed, that they're attaching to these Iranian drones that is not of Iranian origin.
Yeah.
Right? So they're making modifications to that, standardizing the systems. I mean, this is interesting. It's very interesting. So where's that coming from? Probably China.
Yeah.
Right?
You know,
probably.
I think it's important to realize they're probably doing that for expediency reasons. It isn't because they don't lack the technical know-how. Because we both have worked with Russian engineers over the years, and dude, they're good.
Oh, yeah.
They're really good. So there's no way that, you know,
Putin, I think it's about the industry. I think it's about the production industry, the production capabilities, which is why you need to go to China.
Right. Because you can get it quick and cheap. Doesn't have to be good if you get enough of them. Right.
Exactly.
But I can't believe that at the same time, you know, Putin isn't telling the guys, give me the best and brightest, pay them whatever they want, make this better. And, you know, that's a potential massive escalation if that is, in fact, what's going on.
I highly expect weapons development to increase in Russia. So, I mean, and they've already set the footing for this. So it's no different. Ukraine is the start. And you will see Belarus completely reintegrated into Russia within the next 5 or 6 years.
Yeah,
I do not doubt that. And then they're right on the front of the Eastern Bloc. Yeah. So on multiple sides, and they have control of the Black Sea and what's left, you know? And I think what's left becomes up to the Russians and the nationalists that are portraying that narrative there. Again,
I think at some point, and it's going to be soon, you know, the Ukraine war is going to come to an end, and they're just going to say, okay, this is, we've secured whatever geopolitical goals we had. Now it's time to ramp up, you know, the industrial base. And, you know, to what you said earlier, I think you know, probably that is happening behind the scenes. Because now if they can start churning out, you know, high-tech gear, whatever that's going to be, why do you need China? You can just sell it yourself directly into Europe and elsewhere. You know, you're connected to the rest of the world by landmass. It's pretty easy to build rail lines. It's pretty easy to build roads. You know, there you go. And all of a sudden, you're the economic powerhouse of, you know, Eurasia. It's not out of the question. Is it going to happen? You know, I don't know. We'll see.
It depends on how the West responds. Yeah. I think that we're in my fear is that it's multifold. One, people have forgotten what it took to build the stability and structure that we have.
Yeah.
That we are afforded. And now it's all taken for granted because none of us today had to participate in the formings of that.
Right.
Originally.
But, you know, along those lines, what happens after Putin's gone? Because let's be honest, he's old, right? So realistically, yeah, he's probably around for another 10 years, you know, assuming that all those lies about him having cancer and stuff is just that, because he doesn't look like a guy who has cancer to me. But okay, he's gone at some point. Who comes next? Is it somebody who is insecure in the position and then starts lashing out?
What does it make? What sense does it make for news, for media, mainstream media, to make some kind of insane observation based on the limited viewings that we get of him, as if that wasn't even probably scripted, so that we can all be like, you know, like, I mean,
it just shows how bad the propaganda is.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Right. They don't know how to do it right. You know, what's his propaganda? He's riding shirtless on a horse, like some badass warrior from, you know, like every action movie we all watched, right? I mean, I expect him to have, like, you know, two Gatling guns in each of his hands, just blowing away his enemies, right? That's propaganda, guys. You know, none of this stuff about, oh, look how he walks. I mean, come on.
Really? Well, yeah, well, you got to think about what's happening there. So it's like, oh, yeah. You know, you don't really have to worry about this Russia problem because their leader is going to die of cancer in a couple of years.
Well, that's exactly, you know? It. So we don't have to talk about negotiating a settlement. That's, we don't have to talk about treaties. We don't have to talk about, you know, what really prompted all this and do the severe horse trading that needs to happen to ensure peace, right? Exactly. No, we can keep the war going indefinitely. And, you know, the U.S. is learning the lesson because, you know, why is the Israeli conflict dragging on? Where are they getting all their weapons? They're buying them from us, and we can't give it to them fast enough because we can't have, you know, a two-front war supplied at the level that, you know, everybody said they had. And, you know, from my viewpoint, that's good because, you know, maybe at this point people will stop starting to say, hey, default action, blow it up. Default action should be negotiated.
It should be negotiated. It's back to the communication we were talking about in the last episode. We've lost the ability to communicate. Other people want to play ball. They want to try to shape the world into their view, and we're just saying absolutely no. But over here, we can't even agree with ourselves. So who are we to say no? I think the inclusion of people in a reasonable manner, countries otherwise, I mean, ultimately, countries are made up of individuals. We should find where we can get along. And if we can't communicate, we're not going to get very far. I mean, how much is a Javelin missile? I don't know. It's probably $1 million at least. Okay.
Well, like, I saw this, you know, thing where the Houthis are using $10,000 drones to take out shipping in the, you know, in the Gulf and, you know, Mediterranean, wherever they're attacking. Right. Yeah. What are we doing? We're countering it with $1 million cruise missiles. You know, the math doesn't add up because if it's, you know, 100 to 1 different in the economic scale, you know, many PT boats will blow up an aircraft carrier guaranteed. So why do you pursue this ridiculous policy of, you know, using weapons designed to counter other nation states against, you know, rebels. Asymmetrical warfare, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's
again,
it's
like economics. Somebody on the Houthis, well, Houthi, it's Iran at the end of the day.
Iranians, right? Yeah.
You know, they understand economics and they're like, yeah, you know, we can wage the war into oblivion and still achieve political aims on the cheap, whereas U.S. is going to, you know, expend billions to, you know, lose and get nothing out of the conflict.
Well, you make a great point. So the estimated price for a Javelin missile is $250,000.
Yeah.
So how much does it cost Russia to make a tank, right? How much does it cost us to destroy a tank?
Yeah.
And how many of those, what's the efficiency of those weapons?
You know? Right. So Javelin versus, you know, Soviet tank. Yeah. Economic win. Javelin versus Houthi fishing boat. Not so much.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, you imagine the average tank cost is probably in at least $1 million. I would imagine. Jeez, probably two or three.
Dude, way more.
Yeah. So I'm talking in Russia, not in the United States. I mean, the United States, obviously, it's inflated. Like it's like how Cisco prices their devices. It's mark yeah. everything up a billion percent, so you can give everybody 70% off, and they feel like they're winning. Except we don't give anybody the price off for the weapons. The Iranians have been going about this to destabilize the region. So you touched on this a minute ago. So the Houthis being rebels, the Israeli Hamas war, we have the Ukrainian war, we have conflict in Southeastern Asia with Taiwan and yeah. China. Now, the Iranians have done a great job of facilitating proxies to undermine the integrity of the region.
Yeah.
So if you want to break confidence in something, in this case, it's the United States and the Western allies' ability to enforce and protect free trade in that region, and then you undermine the activity, and then you create issues. I mean, what is it? I think even the United States, there was something from the DOD a week or two ago that was talking about like orders couldn't be fulfilled for certain types of ammunition because the production capacity was behind schedule. And it's like, to your point, we're supplying weapons to the Ukrainians and to the Israelis. How many weapons can we supply here? You know, yeah. I feel like I'm playing StarCraft 2, but I have like four bases and three enemies, you know?
So yet again, all that boring stuff they tell you in history about how logistics wins wars. Yeah, here you go. If you can't feed them and if you can't arm them, how are they going to fight? And, you know, again, I wouldn't be surprised if Russia and Iran are coordinating, you know, their respective actions behind the scenes.
They absolutely are. You can see it through the BRICS allocation. And it was announced the other day that Russia, Iran, and China are all participating in joint military exercises in that region.
Yeah.
So to me, it's those three. And I always thought of, you know, for what it's worth, the bear, the leopard, for sure, I could see. But I don't know about the lion. We'll see what happens. But for what it's worth.
But, you know, it goes to show, too, like, all right, we're in World War III, whether anybody wants to admit it or not, right? You know, at least the opening phases, if not beyond that. Everybody Correct. Expects, you know, the next war to look like the last war.
The pawns have been moved, yeah.
Right. You know, but, I mean, apart from that, World War III isn't going to be what we saw, you know, in Europe in the 40s, right? I think we're going to see an extended period of these regional flare-ups that are the moves that the powers are making that aren't going to be evident at the time. They're going to be evident, you know, afterwards. And it's going to happen in a very accelerated way so that I think it'll be over and done with before we understand, you know, what happened and what the ramifications of it all are. This is a different kind of war, and I don't think people are awake to it because, again, nobody studies history properly, so we're repeating the sins of the past because we're ignorant of them.
Well, it's because we're not literate, unfortunately. Therefore, we can't understand it. If there's one more thing that I'd like to tie off here. So think about the production that we've given to China over the past 30 or 40 years. You know, in India and China are like mortal enemies. They have flare-ups all the time. And Pakistan and India, obviously, that happened many years ago.
In Pakistan and Iran 2 weeks ago, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. It was a flare-up because, you know, someone's dog crossed the border and they didn't tell each other, you know? So they have to beat each other up. But they'll end up being homies again, I'm sure. It's interesting. I think we have to pay very close attention. I think this entire effort has been to undermine the integrity. To your point, the World War III is actually being fought now. You know, we're not, everybody thinks it's going to be nuclear, but if it's nuclear, the world's just over. So
what's the point?
Exactly.
You know, wars are fought for objectives. They're not fought for destruction.
Exactly. And the principles of mutually assured destruction and nuclear doctrine of most nations. Kind of basically it says, if you're an equal nuclear power, then we have to revert to conventional warfare because to your point, well, we don't want mass destruction. We want objectives. It's like, they don't want to lose. You hear a lot of rhetoric. You see someone like North Korea on an island, and we talked about that briefly at the start. These guys, famine, like sanctioned all to hell, you know, their population, I think, is 3 or 4 inches shorter than their South Korean counterparts on average due to generational famine. It's a terrible situation, but.
Yeah. And I caught one thing where their language is actually evolving.
Yeah. I saw that.
Yeah. Like, you know, whatever it's been 70 years. It's almost to the point where they're two different languages, so they literally cannot talk to each other, even though
it's like advanced Southern slang, I suppose, compared to us Northern folk.
Yeah, I don't know. I still get along good with the good old boys, so I think we're okay for the time being, at least.
Yeah, for the time being. Yeah, I mean, in the United States, if we maintain the polarization, it might end up in the same way. Who knows?
Yeah.
We'll probably consume ourselves long before that time. But I believe your statement. I don't think we can fight multiple wars on multiple fronts. I don't think we can effectively defend ourselves. I think from a naval perspective, we can project power and protect. But even that's coming into question with enlistment numbers in the United States. I mean, I read another article the other day where they were accepting enlistment without any high school or GED now.
Yeah, so because they've alienated their core base, right? Whoever traditionally used to go into the service isn't doing it anymore because of the political ideology that's corrupted.
Exactly. That's 100% it. That's 100% it. Yeah. So we've subverted our own ability to effectively maintain the systems that have enabled this in the first place, i.e. the ability for the ideologies to form. It's been our unwillingness to confront them, right? To confront the truth and actually say what needs to be said is such that we can maintain order that gives the average person who wants to participate in our society fully the ability and opportunity to do so. And we have got to come back to that.
Yeah.
Hey, this is just a first touching point on some of these topics, and wanted to discuss these for listeners who may not be familiar with some of the geopolitical landscape and especially some of the conflicts that are going on in the world right now. And I do plan on bringing more information in a future episode about other regional affairs that affect our ability and our society. So thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Daniel. Until next time.
Absolutely.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode. Subscribe now to be notified of future episodes and check out our website at theallunknowing.com.